You're listening to Chris Farrell's On Watch podcast from Judicial Watch.
I'm Chris Farrell, and this is On Watch. Welcome to On Watch, everybody. We appreciate you tuning in and listening to us this week's episode. We're very pleased to have with us Colonel Douglas McGregor. He's a decorated combat veteran, the author of 5 books, a PhD, a defense and foreign policy strategist, a brilliant guy who knows the reality of combat on the ground, but also the theory of war and foreign policy. And we appreciate Colonel McGregor taking time to join us. Welcome, Douglas McGregor.
Thanks, Chris.
So I want to get right to it. We've talked with other folks who share similar opinions as you and I do, or at least have healthy skepticism about what's going on in Ukraine and what it means for the United States. I'd like to get your assessment right now of the current state of affairs, the situation on the ground in Ukraine. There's been a lot of talk about a spring offensive. What does that mean? And where do we go? What does success look like for the United States?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that's a question that was not asked in January of 2022 when the decisions were made to do the things we've done. We have to keep in mind that we're at the end of several stages in this conflict on the Russian side. The Russians have now completed their mobilization of 300,000 reservists plus 80,000 additional volunteers. They brought all of their regular forces up to full strength. Their armaments factories are operating 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, producing all the ammunition and new equipment that they need. In fact, I would argue the current Russian army is infinitely better today and more capable today than it was, obviously, over a year ago. And we have ourselves to thank for that. And that's going to continue. When we look at the long-term plans that are being discussed right now, we can expect an even larger force, probably 1 million to 1.2 million, and a much more aggressive force capable of offensive warfare on a scale that we haven't seen certainly since the Second World War. So everyone is miscalculated. Now on the Ukrainian side, we don't know how many Ukrainians have died. I've heard people say 250,000. Others have said 300,000. Others have told me, well, it's probably closer to 350,000. We know that at least 50,000 Ukrainian soldiers lost their lives in this town called Bakhmut, which for some reason became an obsession for Mr. Zelensky on the scale of Hitler's obsession with Stalingrad.
Right.
And despite everyone's recommendations to fall back, establish new defensive positions, he did the opposite. He did what Hitler did, started feeding more and more resources and people into the cauldron. So the Ukrainian armed forces is in very serious trouble. Their air force is irrelevant. They have too many different kinds and sets of equipment. And it's very, very difficult to pull together operations when you're dealing with three or four different kinds of tanks, three or four different kinds of armored personnel carriers, dozens of different standoff attack weapons, artillery, and so forth. And I think that the Ukrainians have a great deal of difficulty putting anything together because the Russians maintain what people in the United States need to understand is persistent surveillance over Ukraine. They have in the space-based category all the capabilities and technologies that we do, so they can see everything in Ukraine all the time.
And I understand, or at least I believe, that the Russians have been enormously effective at interdictive strikes against Ukrainian either stockpiling or marshalling areas where they've done deep strikes in Ukraine and had enormous effect blowing up either reserves, stockpiles of materiel, weapons, ammunition that were supposedly being gathered for this big spring offensive that's been talked about incessantly.
Yes, and at the same time, they've made it practically impossible for the Ukrainians to assemble any large concentrations of troops, because as soon as they're identified, they're brought under effective attack. And contrary to everybody's claims of a few months ago, the Russians are not going to run out of missiles and rockets and artillery ammunition at all. And as I said earlier, the equipment that they've got in the formations is now the best equipment they've had in probably a decade or more. So the one thing that we've accomplished is that we have made the Russian military establishment, probably the most dangerous and lethal modern ground force on the planet. And this force is now ready to attack. But as in the past, I think the Russians are going to move cautiously. They would certainly welcome a major Ukrainian offensive because that would give them the opportunity to annihilate still more troops. And remember, the Russians have never been about gaining and holding ground per se. They've been about destroying the enemy.
Right.
So they now already hold most of the areas that are Russian historically and are populated by Russians. One of the things that took a long time in Bakhmut was that Bakhmut was populated by large numbers of Russians. And Putin would not allow massive strikes out of fear of killing Russians who were being helpful to the Russian forces. In fact, Ukrainians, I listened to their operations and I watched them carefully, and they were complaining routinely about the Russians in Bakhmut telling the Russian forces where the Ukrainians were. So the whole thing was a catastrophe for Ukraine. And as I said, replenishing those troops has been enormously difficult. Right now, they're trying to bring 30 to 35,000 Ukrainian troops back from the United States, Canada, Germany, the Czech Republic, and other places where they've been training so that they can provide the backbone for this new counterattack force. That's still not going to be very large, and they'll probably add 30, 40,000 other troops that may not be very well trained, because most of the competent and professional soldiers the Ukrainians had are either dead or wounded. So it doesn't
look great. My belief is that the average American understanding or sort of depth of knowledge on this subject is woefully inadequate, and that for the most part they've been given this cartoonishly simplistic Ukraine good, Russia bad explanation that doesn't really kind of round out the picture in an accurate way. And you know, we're $150 billion into this war, and you know, there's no end in sight, according to our illustrious president, who, you know, a little over a year ago said, if we give them tanks, it'll be World War III. And you know, we've gone ahead and given them tanks, and now we're winking and nudging about F-16s. How do we translate this? You know, average American happens to stumble upon this podcast and says, wait a minute, I thought Ukrainians were the good guys. Russians are, well, you know, they're Russians. We got to hate them. Mm. How do we communicate effectively so that the average American kind of snaps out of it and realizes the folly of what we're involved in?
Well, as you say, it's very, very difficult. And I'm not sure that we can present to the average American enough information that he or she could take in that would lead them to make more sober judgments. I think what's likely to have a much larger impact is the true economic situation and the financial crisis that looms on the horizon. Americans have been told for years, debt doesn't matter. Forget about it. If you brought up debt and suggested it was an issue, then the quote-unquote smart guys in the room would say, oh, you don't understand. Modern economics, debt doesn't matter. Well, debt does matter, and it's mattering more and more with each passing day. That, I think, Americans can finally understand. And I think as things get worse in that category, along with the destruction of the rule of law in all of our cities, the open borders, where we're admitting millions of people that the left wants very much to replace you and me, and at the same time wants to be sure that they vote in future elections and keep them in power in perpetuity. Once those things begin to sink in, I think you have a very volatile mix here at home. At that point, Americans may say, well, wait a minute, what's the nonsense and why are we still involved?
Right.
But I think right now, until the Russians move decisively, and I think they will this summer, nobody's going to pay a lot of attention. And the Russians have taken remarkably few casualties. We think they may have had 25, 30,000 killed, maybe the same number, a little bit more wounded. And over that period of time, that's very modest for a nation of over, 120, 130 or 140 million people. It has not been bad for them, and their economy has not suffered. Their economy is actually in very good shape, and they're about to hold a meeting in Petersburg with 84 countries from around the world to talk about moving their currency along with China and India and almost everybody else outside of Europe into a gold-backed currency standard. So the situation for us is grows perilously problematic with each passing day, but Americans don't know it. But they'll eventually get an education. In the meantime, I think the Russians are going to wait and see if the Ukrainians are going to do anything. And
if the dollar is destabilized, as you sort of made passing reference to, that will certainly be an attention getter when there's an effort made to move the world reserve currency away from the United States dollar. Two points I want to make briefly and get your reaction to. Number one is we're about at $150 billion in support to Ukraine, plus or minus. Nobody knows the real number. That's a ballpark. But you will recall that Trump wanted $5 billion, a mere $5 billion, to build a border wall and secure our southern border. And that we were told that was impossible. That was reckless. That was crazy money. And I just would like to remind people that the $5 billion for Trump's wall versus the $150 billion for Ukraine's border. There's a little bit of a difference there. And then the second point, I too, many, many moons ago, was an Army officer. And I can tell you that I know very well from being in the field, but it's 19-year-olds that are running the equipment. They're spinning the dials and pushing the buttons on very sophisticated weapon systems. And mistakes happen. In peacetime, mistakes happen. And there can be instances. I just look at this overall situation where we continue to escalate and escalate, both in numbers and types and lethality of weapon systems. And I see ourselves kind of skirting along a real 1914 moment where this could rapidly roll out of control and that we really are playing a very dangerous game in Ukraine. I'd like your opinion on that.
Well, I don't think anybody questions the dangers that you're pointing to, but you've got to step back and look at the reality of American military power. The people in Washington, D.C. behave as though this is the nation of 1991, when we had an army of almost 800,000. We had thousands of aircraft, fighters, bombers, and so forth, where we had a Navy at sea with no competition. There's effectively nobody else in the ocean but us. All of those things have changed. We can't even recruit for the force that we have right now. Its quality has dropped dramatically. Morale is down. I mean, how far do you think you're going to get with drag queens in charge of the armed forces, which is the kind of nonsense that we're seeing increasingly? But the people at the top of the military just want to be promoted, and they privately don't think anything will really happen, that they'll be challenged and actually have to fight. That's a very dangerous mindset, but that's what I've seen. And then there is this insistence on acting as though the Russian is some sort of backward Neanderthal, which is nonsense. In fact, I think the Russian soldiers today are much better than they were when I saw them on active duty in the 70s and 80s. Certainly better than they were during the Second War. This is a very different Russia today. They're thinking soldiers, and they're well-educated, and they're doing a good job. So everything is going to turn on what the Russians do next. And I think given this meeting in Vilnius and given the Petersburg summit, there will be a desire to demonstrate conclusively, I would think, that the Russians are in charge. And indeed, they are. They are the dominant force in this war, not Ukraine. Ukraine is on the ropes. So I think that's going to change things. And all we can do is hope that more sober-minded people will recognize the futility of continuing this and put an end to it. But thus far, we haven't seen any evidence for it. We may see it happen first in Europe, though, Chris. There, things are really bad. Cheap energy is the lifeblood of civilizations and certainly vital to our scientific industrial societies and production. We've screwed ourselves ultimately on energy here at home. So have the Europeans, but they went even further than we have. And I think the conditions in Germany are bad, are going to get a lot worse. The thing is also the case in France and other countries. So I would look to Paris and Berlin and see if there's real change in the offing there. If there is, then there's a chance that this could end with some sort of settlement, because everybody knows the Russians are not going to abandon what they have. And they're probably going to expand it this summer into both Odessa and Kharkov, both of which are historically Russian cities and which the Russians want to control again.
Colonel Douglas McGregor, we appreciate your time. You have incredible insight. It's powerful. You're articulate. You give clear examples. And it's refreshing to get your perspective. Thank you for your time and for joining us on Watch.
Sure. Thank you, Chris.
I'm Chris Farrell on Watch.
Thanks for listening to Chris Farrell's On Watch podcast. For more information, visit www.judicialwatch.org, because no one is above the law.